CB Studios from the Constitutional Council's Research Center to share with us his exacting knowledge of the law with regard to the President and leaders' authorities and how they've manifested in practice. Why do foreign media tend to paint a pale, ineffective picture of Iran's presidency?
Basically, because they don't want the Islamic Republic to develop and make progress, the foreigners try to target the pillars of power in Iran, cast doubt about it by encouraging speculation about elections, about their reliance on people's votes, about self-confidence, independence, confidence in countries' internal capabilities, and the use of Iran's scientific capacities. Issues, including our nuclear program, which has been the culmination of scientific and technical advancements made by the young people in our country, are being targeted by foreigners.
Then again, the highest authority in the country not being the president might give the impression his hands are tied beside a leader and commander of all armed forces and powers, except the leader is not known to exert his influence irrationally in foreign affairs, a sensitive matter to him actually as someone who has expressed categorical mistrust for the U.S. That would be Ayatollah Khamenei.
The leader is in a sense a policymaker and an observer at the highest level of how the goals of the system are being achieved. As described by the preamble of Constitution, the leader's role is to keep the system on its original Islamic path. There might be an administration whose policies aren't in line with that of the leader, meaning that the leader would adopt different positions if he were to take the helm. But because people cast their ballots for that administration and preferred its stance, the leader allows the cabinet to follow its goals so far as they agree with the Constitution.
دولت بر اساس قانون آن چرا که مورد توجهش بوده دنبال میکنه
ببین دولت هاشمی دولت به خصوص
Look, Hashemi's government was a specific one with its particular orientations, behaviors and management type. Mr. Khatami's cabinet was a polar opposite to its predecessor. People felt Mr. Khatami's government was the exact opposite of that of Mr. Hashemi and voted for him. The same goes for Mr. Ahmadinejad's government. Mr. Rouhani's administration also opposed Mr. Ahmadinejad's policies. If it were true that the president takes ceremonial positions, we wouldn't witness such disparity in opinions and performances among the governments during all these years.
For a better understanding of roles of power and their extension, let's put faces to them by introducing presidents that have come and gone since Iran's millennia-old monarchy fell with the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Presidents' backgrounds, that is, and what became of them after their governance. Governing institutions will also be touched upon in today's episode. I'll begin with the leader, however, who was himself president when the Assembly of Experts selected him to replace Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, first leader of the Islamic Republic, upon his demise 10 years since the revolution. Now 81, the then young cleric Sayyid Ali Khamenei in the early 1960s joined the religious opposition movement of Ayatollah Khomeini against the king or shah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. In 1979, when the revolution happened, he served on the Revolutionary Council, which ruled alongside the interim government. He subsequently became Deputy Defense Minister and helped organize the IRGC, Islamic Revolution Guard Corps. Sayyid Ali Khamenei did not become president right after Abul Hasan Banisadr. The second president was Muhammad Ali Rajai, who was short-lived in years and professionally. It was after his assassination that Sayyid Ali Khamenei ascended to the presidency, a presidency that continued by promotion to leadership, the highest position in the country. Already an ardent advocate of the concept of velayat-e-faqih, that's governance by the religious jurist, Sayyid Ali Khamenei was among the founding members of the IRP, that's the Loyalist Islamic Republican Party. In 1981, when the IRP's upper ranks were shattered by a series of bombings that killed the party's secretary-general and President Rajai, Ayatollah Khamenei had himself gotten paralyzed in the right arm, but was promoted to IRP secretary-general. And within weeks, he became the IRP's candidate for the presidency and was elected to succeed Rajai. At the time, the presidency was largely ceremonial and with the greater power vested in the Prime Minister, Mir Hossein Mousavi, at the time. Our guest explains why the presidency in Iran is more complex and challenging than other countries at large.
The first thing to take into account is how the political system looks, what the mechanisms are, what form the institutions take, and how it formulates the political order. They aren't to be taken as gospel. For instance, there might be a presidency or a chancellorship, such as what we see in Germany. There are countries, including the UK, that have a prime minister. The US, France, and Germany all have their way of running the country. There are disparate forms of political systems among the countries that claim to be democratic. The fact that they differ in their form doesn't mean they're necessarily anti-democratic or have imposed specific constraints on democracy.
From what you say, the leader minimally interferes in the president's affairs. So why is Iran painted as a totalitarian system?
Speaking of totalitarian regimes, one of their key characteristics is that they don't observe the rule of law, or that they're oppressive toward their people and depend on foreigners. These are characteristics that have been mentioned in constitutional books. They don't depend on the people. This is why the Islamic Republic of Iran has held nearly 44 elections over the 42 years that have elapsed since the victory of the Islamic Revolution. And that's not counting midterm elections. If we include them too, the figure will rise over 200 elections. The lowest turnout in Iran's election has been the highest figure in other countries' elections. If we consider this, we'll see that the Islamic Republic has always stressed the importance of people's role. Article 177 of the Constitution has made this principle basically irrevocable. That's why the characteristics of the Islamic Republic can never be compared to these totalitarian regimes that don't observe the rule of law.
Now, as leader, what differences might have occurred with presidents that have succeeded him and served under his leadership? Mohammad Khatami, a reformist, was president from 1997 to 2005. He pushed for détente with the West and more social and political freedom in Iran. After two terms, the maximum length in office, he was succeeded by conservative Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Khatami was with Ahmadinejad's rival, former and last prime minister, Mir Hossein Mousavi, at the time. That's during the events of 2009, which led to Mousavi's house arrest.
Ms. Zohra Elahian is an MP and on the Parliamentary Committee for National Security and Foreign Policy. So we made the trek down to Parliament to hear her views on all matters presidential.
Unfortunately, two of the presidential candidates in 2009 voiced their objections outside the legal norm, which led to chaos and crisis in the country and endangered the national security and the interests of the people. The main problem was that the two candidates didn't respect the country's legal structure. They didn't pursue their objection to the election result through its legal course and try to draw people on the streets, even though the leader of the Islamic Revolution said the complaints and electoral process can be legally reviewed. But unfortunately, these candidates didn't choose the legal path and issued provocative statements to bring people on the streets.
Yet Khatami was invited to join the Expediency Council as a member, but he declined the offer. He never gave up political activity, however. His activity was extensive since 1988. He has in fact been considered the reason for Mr. Rouhani's victory in the presidential elections of 2013 and 2017. To fall back into sequencing, Mohammad Khatami was succeeded by a conservative Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Tehran mayor. He was seen by some as a protege of Ayatollah Khamenei. but he faced mounting criticism over his government's management of the economy and foreign policy decisions. And finally, he fell out with the leader after reportedly trying to increase his own powers to ends not favorable to the leadership. He still remained in office. His two terms ended 8 years ago, but to this day he remains in the Expediency Council, a high body advising the leader. I asked, why would you say some Iranian presidents change course after their term or when it's coming to a close?
Unfortunately, it's possible for some presidents who have the experience of being in office for 4 or 8 years to not obtain a clear understanding of the country's legal and political system, or they might receive wrong advice, so they might depart from the legal path. We saw the example in 2009 when this lack of proper understanding of the political and legal system and ignoring the national interest and security created crises and challenges in the country, which cost the people some damage. It basically goes back to the president and the advice he receives.
Why have some of our presidents taken a different route once they finished with their presidency or towards the end of their terms?
به هر حال اون دو سال پایانی وقتی که دولت‌ها بر سر کار هستن.
Anyhow, in the last 2 years of a government's terms, such issues might occur because of several reasons. One is that they're coming closer to their end of the term in office and see themselves less reliant on the people's support. They even find themselves less in need of support from the political system. At the same time, they want to stay at the highest possible level of power after leaving office.
Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was succeeded in 2013 by now outgoing President Hassan Rouhani, who after two terms in office, like most before him, will be handing down his responsibilities to President-elect Ebrahim Raisi in early August. Now, Rouhani's office has been interesting, both lauded and lamented at the same time. It's interesting to see where he will land. But during office, he negotiated the landmark nuclear deal, the JCPOA, with world powers. Although warned against trusting the US by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader still gave him his blessing and go ahead with the deal.
در نظر داشته باشیم که اختیاراتی که قانون اساسی به رئیس جمهور داده.
Keep in mind that the powers conferred on the president by the Constitution are specified in Article 113, which specifies executive powers of the leader, which is very brief, and as stated by Article 110, all other powers go to the president. In line with this, making decisions about the country's revenue, based on Article 52 of the Constitution, is with the government, which is headed by the president. It's the president who determines how the revenue is spent. That's specified in the budget bill, which is presented by the government, headed by the president.
Now, talking of sequencing, an important link was left out. That would be President Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, who, like the early building blocks of the revolution, is associated with the IRP and Revolutionary Council. He was the two-term president before President Khatami and after the once president Khamenei. I left him out as his office in those earlier days of the revolution is not associated with the matter of how much the leader may have exerted influence on his decision-making. Mind you, he did look to reducing Iran's international isolation by reviewing ties with Europe. This would be part of a greater strategy to use foreign investment and free enterprise to boost the country's war-torn economy. We are talking the eight-year Iraq-Iran War of the 1980s. And domestically, he implemented family planning policies to reverse policies that would lead to population growth. This was against the background of a very principalist establishment and leadership. Not to forget, Rafsanjani was instrumental in preparing the conditions for President Khamenei to succeed the then leader Ayatollah Khomeini. Rafsanjani, despite all the differences of opinion in the fields of foreign policy and production and industry with some principalists and reformists, remained in high positions, such as chairman of the Expediency Council and chairman of the Assembly of Leadership Experts.
Marhum Rafsanjani
The late Rafsanjani has long been one of the key figures in the Islamic Revolution and an important figure in the political arena in the country. But at some point, unfortunately, some of the positions and actions were somewhat at odds with the views of the leader of the Islamic Republic. However, the leader always wanted to avoid rifts from being created between the officials, especially between himself and Mr. Hashemi Rafsanjani, and always tried to manage the situation to prevent that rift from taking shape.
I've pointed more or less to the backgrounds of the President and Prime Minister Mousavi. To put in a little more where I've left it thin, Mir Hossein Mousavi, architect, painter, intellectual and politician, served as Iran's Prime Minister from 1981 to 1989, and afterwards as presidential advisor from 1989 to 2005. That's advisor to two prominent presidents, Rafsanjani and Khatami. He was a member of various councils and assemblies for many years after being the Prime Minister, and his consultations were put to use.
Even after the events of 2009, the system did not try him, but put him under siege. Mousavi's marvel during premiership was that he managed to control the inflation and ensure the reliable availability of essential items during the long-drawn imposed war with Iraq. He served as a member on the Expediency Council and Council of Guardians, now known as the Constitutional Council.
Khatami, during the 1960s and 70s, gained a reputation as an opponent of the rule of the Shah. After the 1979 Islamic Revolution, he was elected to the Majlis, or Parliament, and later became Minister of Culture twice. In 1997, he won a landslide presidential victory with almost 70% of the vote by an electorate looking for more socio-political freedom and an open economy inviting foreign investment.
The presidency in Iran is somehow more sensitive in that. A significant number of powerful governments in the world are trying to create hurdles for this key post in the Islamic Republic of Iran. In this way, the presidency is more serious, special and unique compared to the same post or its equivalent chancellorship or premiership in other countries. But in terms of its internal reality, it's like any other political system. The president has the highest executive powers in the country and is carrying out his duties.
I mentioned high councils former presidents have found themselves in to continually put in practice their experiences gained during presidency. To clarify, the Expediency Council is an advisory body for the leader with an ultimate adjudicating power in disputes over legislation between the Parliament and the Guardian Council or Constitutional Council. The leader appoints its members from among prominent religious, social, and political figures. In October 2005, he gave the Expediency Council supervisory powers over all branches of government.
The Assembly of Experts for the Leadership is an 88-member body of Islamic jurists, elected once every 8 years by direct popular vote. Their mandate by constitution is to appoint, monitor, and possibly dismiss the leader. Candidacy for this council depends on approval by the Constitutional Council, a 12-member body appointed by the leader and parliament, as well as being an Islamic jurist.
Usually, the Expediency Council enlists the help of the previous presidents. This council can bring different branches of the government together and resolve the differences between the president and the parliament and offer advice to the leader about the general policies of the system. This is an important position where previous presidents play a role, but some presidents have been left outside due to their weak performance. It's only natural for a president who's been in office for many years but doesn't have a clear understanding of the political and legal structure and whose performance has harmed the public and national security to be left aside. It's better that he is limited so he can't do further damage to the national interests and the security.
Since so many of the said positions are filled by election, allow me to say where national elections are held. They are held to decide on a president, members of parliament, assembly of experts members, and city and village councillors. Parliament or Majlis has 290 members currently, elected for a four-year term in multi- and single-seat constituencies. Ms. Elahian believes the importance of elections is undisputed, unquestionable.
The fact that different media are focusing their attention on Iran's president proves that it's a very important political and executive position in the country and is far from ceremonial. That's why the media are focusing on this issue, which is also being talked about on an international scale. The other point is that the presidents have to be responsible for their performance both during their term and after they leave office. This is because the management of the significant portion of the country, its structure and budget, is given to the president and his team, and he enjoys the powers that people grant him by their votes. The president and his ministers have to be responsible for the power given to them during the 4 or 8 years in office.
That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after for a dip into any manner of matters Iranian or a visit to any personality or walk of life. Bye for now.
Ravi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Ravi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ravi English Radio.
The limelight.
Former President Donald Trump has recently issued a statement saying that Americans are refusing to take the coronavirus vaccine due to mistrust of the Biden administration, the media, and the 2020 presidential election results. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Natalie Colarossi Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Trump says Americans refusing to take the vaccine due to mistrust of Biden administration. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Former President Donald Trump issued a statement recently saying that Americans are refusing to take the coronavirus vaccine due to mistrust of the Biden administration, the media, and the 2020 presidential election results. Joe Biden kept talking about how good of a job he's doing on the distribution of the vaccine that was developed by Operation Warp Speed, or quite simply, the Trump administration. He's not doing well at all, Trump's statement said. He's way behind the schedule, and people are refusing to take the vaccine because they don't trust his administration. They don't trust the election results, and they certainly don't trust the fake news, which is refusing to tell the truth, the statement added. Though Trump's administration faced criticism for a slow vaccine rollout that significantly lagged behind expectations in December and January, the former president has continuously praised his COVID-19 response team and pointed fingers at President Joe Biden. Since leaving office, Trump has also continued to push the conspiracy theory that the election was stolen due to mass voter fraud. Trump's recent statement comes just 2 weeks after the Biden administration failed to reach its vaccination goal of partially inoculating at least 70% of Americans by July 4th. Some 90 million eligible people in the United States have yet to receive at least one shot. Now, Biden's administration is scrambling to vaccinate more Americans as COVID-19 cases are rising across the United States due to the highly contagious Delta variant. According to a recent report from the CDC, coronavirus cases across the United States are up by nearly 70%, and hospitalizations are up by 36% from the previous week. At least 38 states in the United States have shown a 50% increase of new cases in the past week, with the variant appearing to spread fastest among unvaccinated populations. Recently, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy said that 99.5% of new COVID-19 deaths are happening among unvaccinated people and expressed concern that the issue could quickly become worse. I am worried about what is to come because we are seeing increasing cases among the unvaccinated in particular. And while if you are vaccinated, you are very well protected against hospitalization and death. Unfortunately, that is not true if you are not vaccinated, Murthy said recently on CNN's State of the Union. The Biden administration has said some of the blame falls on social media companies, arguing that Americans are refusing to be vaccinated due to the rapid spread of misinformation online. Recently, Biden said the amount of misinformation on Facebook and other social media sites was killing people, and added that the only pandemic we have is among the unvaccinated population. In response, Facebook issued a statement saying that 85% of its users were vaccinated or planned to be, and the administration was looking for scapegoats for missing their vaccine goals. Christopher Krebs, the former director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, said recently that while Facebook and other social media companies can provide helpful information on the pandemic and vaccine safety, misinformation is likely going to continue to spread. Krebs added that the amount of vaccine misinformation online is akin to the way misinformation about the 2020 presidential election spread. What we are seeing here is an ecosystem of information purveyors. Some of this is politically motivated. Some of it is the anti-vax community. Some of it is profiteering. And I tend to believe that there is a lot of that going on here, he said during a CBS interview recently. The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, recently there have been demonstrations as the Cubans continue to deal with harsh American sanctions. And the president of this island nation is pointing the finger at Washington once again for provoking and encouraging unrest in Cuba. Well, stay with us as we put the spotlight on Cuba. This edition.
The rally in Havana, with tens of thousands of Cubans taking part. They came together to voice support for the island's government and protest what they see as the U.S. meddling in their country's internal affairs. The rally was held just days after unprecedented unrest erupted in Cuba over an economic crisis aggravated by the coronavirus pandemic. Revolutionary leader Raul Castro and the Cuban president were among those attending the event.
We have come together to once again denounce the U.S. blockade, aggression, and terror. We could not put off this rally. The enemy has once again given everything to destroy the sacred unity and peace of citizens.
The Cuban president criticized the U.S. for spreading false information on social media. He also blasted Washington for defaming his government and inciting hatred and violence. He said the U.S. seeks to undermine peace and stability in Cuba. Criticism of U.S. policies vis-à-vis Cuba has not been limited to its shores. Russia has also accused the U.S. of plotting a color revolution in Cuba.
The logic is simple here. It has been tested on numerous occasions by Washington in various situations. But everything is the same, instigating color revolutions against undesirable regimes. At first, sanctions are introduced against them, and artificial problems are created or imposed from outside, which complicate the social and economic situation. On this basis, tensions are provoked, and anti-government sentiment is stirred up. When a critical mass is reached, the whole blame is laid on the national government. Labels are pinned on it, its activity is discredited, and thus the situation nears a collapse.
Iran, too, says the U.S. is the root cause of many of the problems in Cuba and should end its unilateral sanctions on the Caribbean nation. The bans were first imposed in 1960 in response to Havana's nationalization of U.S.-owned oil refineries following the Cuban Revolution. The sanctions were later extended. Even racial justice group Black Lives Matter publicly condemned the trade blockade, saying it's at the heart of Cuba's current crisis. In June, a total of 184 countries voted in favor of a UN resolution to demand an end to the US economic blockade on Cuba. Only the US and Israel voted against. That was the 29th consecutive year that the UN General Assembly called for the U.S. to end its Cuba embargo. Washington has ignored the international plea every time. U.S. President Joe Biden has called Cuba a failed state. The Cuban leaders deny that. But even if it's true, that claim serves more as an admission of guilt on the part of the U.S. than castigation of the island nation.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight. Out of Leesburg, Dennis Small, Latin American expert. And out of Washington, D.C., Shel Labash, writer and anti-imperialist activist. Thank you both for being with me. Let's start this off with Dennis. Your perspective, how do you assess the effect of over 60 years of sanctions by the U.S. on Cuba?
Well, I think these sanctions have been wrong for each and every one of those 60 years. But unfortunately, what we're facing today is a very different context than what has existed until now. And I think that the current sanctions against Cuba and the activities in the Caribbean more broadly are actually very, very dangerous. What I mean is the following. We're facing an international financial breakdown crisis underway in the transatlantic sector. This is something which my magazine, Executive Intelligence Review, has documented in detail. And what you therefore have is among those big financial interests an intent on a radical shift in the direction of world politics as a whole. I think that the blockade and what's happening with Cuba is even worse than it has been described in two regards. First, it is under conditions of a pandemic. That was mentioned, I think, very importantly so in your lead up to this discussion. Under current conditions, where we have a global pandemic which is out of control, to impose sanctions on countries that are facing this is tantamount to genocide. And I would like to strongly agree with what the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, has said, which is that all sanctions should be lifted under these conditions. I personally believe all sanctions should be lifted altogether, but certainly under these conditions. What's happening in various countries with the pandemic, it makes the issues of sanctions and regime change and color revolutions all the worse. Mm-hmm. The second feature of the current development, which I think is really serious, is that it occurs along with similar and related activities in places like Haiti and in South America, and in South Africa as well, not just South America, but South Africa. So I'll leave that for further elaboration.
Okay, well, what about what Dennis said? I mean, he talked about the UN Secretary General Guterres and basically saying, especially under these conditions with the pandemic, that sanctions should be removed. What does that mean exactly? If the UN Secretary General is saying that, if the majority of member states are for that, but then nothing happens, nothing changes, so tell me, what's going on here? What does it all mean?
Well, it all means, as my colleague said, that there is a global initiative on the part of the United States to restructure the world under its domination. Those days are past, but they are not sparing anyone in their and they're striving for hegemony. If you look at, of course, all of the sanctions should be lifted. It's unjust for unilateral economic war to be perpetrated on the people around the world. And Cuba's only one place. It's just the longest one and the one that's closest to the United States. But all of the sanctions should be lifted. I mean, has anybody looked at the fact that without a global response to the pandemic, the coronavirus is not going to go away? And the people who do not have vaccines are basically being thrown to death. And human beings are not expendable. That's a little bit the problem. You see this settler colonial imperialist attitude on the part of the United States saying, well, we're vaccinating people here. But the fact of the matter is, until the whole world is protected against the coronavirus, no one is going to be saved.
Let me cross back over to Dennis. I mean, it's part of a live program, right? Well, Dennis, your take on, you heard what Cheryl was saying. I mean, at the end of the day, what is the U.S. after in continually putting this type of pressure on Cuba? Because she talked about basically that every life is relevant and valuable, but it doesn't seem to be part of the equation in that settler colonialist mentality. How do you see it?
Well, I think you have to just distinguish, there's different forces at play inside the United States, as there are in many countries around the world. And I think it's important to understand that there are distinctions in different points of view. Let me explain what I mean. There is an alternative that has been built over the last number of years internationally to the current bankrupt world financial system. And just parenthetically, when I say bankrupt, I mean bankrupt. You have $2 quadrillion in derivatives and financial speculation, which cannot be paid. And the attempt to hold up that bubble is what is behind the war drive. It is what is behind the austerity leading to the pandemic. It is what is behind all of these regime change operations, not just in a country like Cuba or Iran or Venezuela, but attempted regime change in Russia and China. That's what you're getting from the Wall Street and the City of London crowd. But the alternative that is existing at this point and that needs to be backed is what the Chinese have initiated with the Belt and Road Initiative, which many countries have joined in on at this point, in fact, the majority of the world's population, which has a different kind of approach to economics, which is not speculation and looting, but rather infrastructure and economic development. You can see the differences in the way the pandemic has been taken on. Now, we have an immediate situation around Afghanistan, which is, on the one hand, a very gravely dangerous situation, but also offers opportunities for a new kind of approach. Dangerous because with the departure of American troops, which is 20 years overdue after a 20-year war, and which many people in the United States, even included in the military, think that these perennial wars have simply got to stop. But you have a situation where, on the one hand, Afghanistan could easily tilt into becoming a center of world terrorism, of world drugs, of geopolitical destabilization and explosions. On the other hand, you have a confluence of forces coming together around the recent SCO meeting where the neighbors of Afghanistan, even though they have differences among them.
Okay. Well, now it seems to be Dennis's turn.
The forces that can actually help build.
Okay, Dennis, I'm sorry. I think it's your turn right now. We're having a little technical difficulty with you. Let me cross back over to Cheryl now. Cheryl, when we look at it, I mean, even when we're talking about the blockade or the sanctions on Cuba, I mean, isn't the main problem, it's not just the unilateral sanctions by the U.S., it's that the United States will punish or sanction any entity that actually want to have economic relationship with the country. Otherwise, if it was just the United States in itself, there would be so many other alternatives, but that it shuts down everyone and all other countries. Your take.
Yes, the extraterritorial nature of the blockade is really what is insidious. People in the United States, when they saw Barack Obama go to Cuba, it was like, everything is fine now. There's no blockade, relations are quote unquote normal. But the fact of the matter is, even then, the blockade, the economic sanctions, the economic warfare against Cuba continued. And what happens is the laws are so convoluted and complex that it becomes almost impossible to have trade. For example, to have a sale of pharmaceuticals, according to the U.S. law, you have to have a license. Okay, that's fine. To get that license, you have to agree to send a person to Cuba to verify that the end users are the end users. It's not a free and fair trade arrangement where people can, you know, Cubans can buy from the United States and people and businesses can sell. It's all controlled by the U.S. government, and they make conditions so onerous that it's impossible to do. And then third countries, like, for example, one that's used frequently is that the embassy, the Cuban embassy in Canada, leased Honda vehicles. Should be simple. They go to a Honda dealership in Canada, they lease the vehicle. It turned out that Honda was fined for doing that. because the financial route goes through California, where their leasing office, their big international leasing office is. So even the small thing of leasing a vehicle, of getting deliveries from DHL, now remittances are cut because Western Union can't process remittances to Cuban families. The web is just so hard to negotiate, and it affects the whole world. That's really what's happening, and that's why it needs to end completely. There's the people of the United States are standing up against the blockade. We have resolutions from elected officials and city labor councils all across this country, representing more than 30 million people in the United States. We have people in every state of the union who will stand up and say, hands off Cuba. We are growing the movement here to tell the U.S. government that it is time to end the blockade, and that we're not going to be distracted by this, you know, by all of these lies about what's happening in Cuba that are being fomented through a cyber war.
Dennis, you heard what Shell said, but I want to look at one aspect of that, because she talked about the growing numbers, the grassroots movement. But in general, is it about the numbers? Because if we're talking about majority, we know that 189 countries actually voted against continued sanctions. So she talked about 30 million people, for example, grassroots movement. Is it about the number of people that can pressure the U.S. government, or is it about the 1% which controls the U.S. government that actually that's where they make the whatever decision they want to make?
I don't think it's either. I think the growth of 30 million people on policies that are appropriate is very good. But I want to emphasize that we're facing a different situation than we've been looking at for decades. There is a world financial breakdown crisis underway. That opens great dangers and great possibilities for a change in the big picture. If we don't change that big picture, the littler pictures, with all due respect to smaller countries, is not going to change. You have on the global strategic scene an alternative which is being put together around the Belt and Road Initiative, and that is an extraordinarily important counterweight, which is an area which people inside the United States should link up with. To bring sufficient pressure on this to change the situation, you're going to have to address the underlying blowout conditions in the world financial system and the economy, which is springing up these crises, creating these crises in various places. Listen, on this Cuba question, the president of Haiti was assassinated 4 or 5 days before the big demonstrations or the little demonstrations in Cuba, the unusual demonstrations in Cuba. Within 2 days of the president of Haiti's assassination, one of the three governments of Haiti that was claiming to be the government called for the United States to send in troops. Now, as of now, the Biden administration has said no, but it's not a very strong no. And I believe this is a very real possibility, given that there are people who are looking for a war with Russia around Ukraine and a war with China around Taiwan. So I think it's very important to look at the big picture. People should recall that Cuba is closer to Haiti than it is to the United States. We have the proverbial 90 miles or 103 miles between Cuba and Florida, but there's 60 miles from Cuba to Haiti. And the part of Cuba which is closest to Haiti is Guantanamo. Now, I'm not saying we're going to have another Bay of Pigs tomorrow, but I am saying there is an intention from a policy layer internationally to create crises everywhere to maintain their global system in place, and it's a financial system. Therefore, I think it's most useful to look at how to affect that global problem, change that, if we hope to have changes in policy such as this not only criminal but really stupid policy, suicidal policy of sanctions against countries like Cuba or Venezuela or Iran and so forth. I mean, after all, we may think that we have a wall built around the rest of the world on the pandemic, but I would recommend that people read Edgar Allan Poe's story on the mask of the Red Death. as to what happens when people think that they can simply wall themselves out of a problem which is international, and the pandemic does not respect borders or anything of the sort. It's good we've got vaccines here. The whole world should have them, but the vaccines will not stand up to new variants if we don't guarantee that the entire planet is safe from this problem. So that's what I mean by the global problems.
Joe, your take, because we're just about, we're running out of time. What needs to happen to change the status quo? I mean, we've been looking at this since 1959, since the victory of the Cuban Revolution in that country, the continual pressure by the U.S., the sanctions by the U.S., the military aggression also, and threats. What has to change?
Well, what has to change what is what we in the United States can do, because fundamentally, even though we laud the support from around the world and the voices from around the world, and it's very necessary, but fundamentally, it's our responsibility. It is a government that is acting in our name. And we have to really find a way, and that's why I emphasize that we've been doing this grassroots work. We have elected officials, we have elected bodies. I couldn't agree more that there are at least three, maybe more international crises that are transforming our world, not in a good way. One is the economic financial crisis, one is the pandemic, and the other is the environment. These crises are not going to be postponed. They're going to cause all sorts of problems and hardships inside our country, okay. Countries generally. Okay. So we have to step up the fight here at home.
And Dennis, 40 seconds. What needs to happen in your perspective?
The United States should join with China, Russia, and other countries in the Belt and Road Initiative. The fact that President Biden did sit down to talk with Putin is very positive, even though nothing in particular came out of that, except the continuation of talks, recently a four-hour discussion. It is in the self-interest of the United States to work, for example, with China to build up the economic situation throughout the entire Caribbean region, Mexico. If you have illegal migration, you have to build these areas up economically and make them strong. And I think that this is something which the United States must be brought to understand is in our own self-interest.
Okay. And on that note, I hate to interrupt you both, but I appreciate you being with us. We're out of time. Dennis Small, Latin American expert out of Leesburg, and Cheryl Labash, writer and anti-imperialist activist out of Washington, D.C. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.